Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We will take up a topic here this morning that we have discussed on and off over the years that we've been doing this program. We'll be talking about current issues in education. And our guest for the program is Mary Calanzas. She is Dean of the College of Education here at the University of Illinois. We'll be trying to talk a little bit about what we can say today about student performance and how we measure that, about how we stack up against other countries, about what this administration and the previous administration have talked about in terms of strengthening schools, and take whatever kinds of questions and comments that people who are listening have. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do that very easily by calling us at 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have email. So if you'd like to send along your questions and comments that way, you can do that. And that is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call or write us if you'd like to join the conversation. And welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, David.
We appreciate it. As I was thinking about having this conversation this morning with you, I was thinking about the fact that we now on this program have been on the air for 30 years and have talked about schools quite often, going all the way back to the early 80s when we were talking about the now famous report, Nation at Risk, that was issued by the Reagan administration. At that time, big concern was that over the previous couple of decades, student performance had declined. American students did not compare favorably with students in other industrial countries. And this was ringing the alarm bell. And since that time, there have been endless commissions and reports, and people have put forth all kinds of ideas on improving public education. Now, as we look at where we are now, one wouldn't say there had been no improvement, but nothing like what we would hope for. Why is it that given all the talk and all the effort that we put into it, the improvement has been so small?
Right. Well, I mean, we do have to acknowledge that there has been improvement. That's really important, and particularly for groups that 30 years ago were at the bottom of the pile and were excluded from, you know, life's chances. There has been a very, very significant changes. However, my own view is that there's something in the American system that will always produce a huge gap, and there are different indicators and different reasons for it. It goes right back, if you want to accept this thesis, right back to the idea of live free or die, right? This kind of radical belief in freedom, a radical belief in not paying taxes, even though you pay a lot of taxes, this idea that you don't, and local control. And so whilst ever schools are funded by local taxes, you know, land taxes, you will get a huge differential between high-performing areas and low-performing areas, because we all know that the socioeconomic dimension plays such a big part in performance. And, you know, all the data shows that to us. And usually what we tend to do is put in programs that I regard as torturing the poor rather than helping them achieve. Whilst those who achieve very well and do very well internationally on all indicators, you know, go out there and do sport and theatre and ride horses and, you know, have a rich curriculum, whilst we use measures that we think are scientific that can be reported out to the public that don't produce the same kind of results as a rich education might produce.
Mm-hmm. Well, here now you've opened the door to several areas that we could talk about, among them issues like local control and how we measure student performance and so forth. But let me ask, as people will hear and maybe will know, you have done a lot of your growing up, your education, and your professional activity as an educator in Australia.
Right.
And have been here at University of Illinois since 2006. And I know that you have had the opportunity to look at some school systems in other countries as
right.
well. I'm like to have you talk a little bit more about what it is you see when you compare American students with those, particularly in other industrialized countries,
right.
because it seems fairly consistently at least over the last few decades, that American students have lagged behind, in particularly in math and science.
Right, and
there could be all sorts of reasons for this. Maybe in part that there is in this country no unified curriculum, and everybody's kind of on their own. How do you account for that big difference?
Well, actually, you know, it's PISA results and international results that come up with these huge gaps internationally. When you disaggregate them, America does very well, because the enigma of America is that it has school systems and school results that are the best in the world, and school results that, given the wealth of the nation, are the worst in the world. It's always number one and number 10. It's a huge spectrum, and it goes back to the, from my perspective, to the sorts of factors that I mentioned earlier. And whilst you have the legacy just to be really strong about it, the legacy of slavery right through, you know, America was segregated in our lifetime, David, yours and mine. It wasn't a long time ago, so that legacy is still there. You have immigration, and both legal and illegal immigration, that brings in people who want to improve themselves. You have a system of freedom that allows people to be poor. So those factors come together to produce poor performance in certain areas. Again, take any of the PISA results on any of those subject areas and disaggregate for poverty, disaggregate for location, and you will find that America still performs the best in the world and the worst in the world. So we really have to tackle that reality.
Hmm. Well, how much of this has to do with the wide disparity, and it is indeed very wide, from one state to another or within a state,
right,
in the amount of money that individual districts have to spend on their kids.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned my growing up in Australia. Australia is a level country. It punches above its weight in educational terms. It does very well from preschool right through to higher education. However, it funds education through income tax, you know, at the state and at the national level. And so it is a very level system, because you can rely on every student getting, no matter where they are, sufficient money to be able to do what they need to do in the school system. They don't have to rely on funding from gift money. They don't have to go out begging for extra resources. They know that every school will get sufficient to do what is required. We have national guidelines, light guidelines, not heavy guidelines. I think all the international data shows us the more you try to control a school, the less flexibility and freedom a school has, the poorer the results are, because they can't adapt quickly to the realities. What they do is produce cookie-cutter solutions to classroom needs rather than the rich, complex responses that are required given diversity in our classrooms. So America does not have a national system. It will never actually have a system. In fact, one of the things that the Obama government has tried to do very quickly is to put some elements of what might be a national system around assessment, around Common Core standards, around entry into higher ed. But you see, once you do that, you also have a leveling effect, right? Mm-hmm. Remember my little joke that I had in my notes that I gave to you was, you know, an American speaking to a Danish person, and the American says to the Danish person, "Oh, I love Northern Europe. It's just fantastic. You know, you perform so highly. You always do fantastic." Well, the Danish person says back to the American, "Yeah, you know, we kind of always score number three. You know, we're a very comfortable country. But you guys, you're number one and you're number 10, and that surpasses everybody in the world." So whilst this huge country, and it is a big country, produces cutting-edge, breakthrough knowledge and fantastically high-performing students at one end, it seems to be able to tolerate a very long tail of underachievement. Makes a lot of noise about the tail, because that's, we only ever hear about that. You know, we're not doing enough, we're not performing, you know, we've got to drill and kill more if we can. You know, like, what can, you know, 2 hours of math? No, 3 hours of math drill, 3 hours of literacy drill. How can we, you know, kind of force things down kids' necks so that they perform better in a test, so that we can show some marginal scientific differences. And you see, whilst that model is so entrenched, it's going to be hard to do what's required in a classroom to care for those kids that are there, to have them enjoy coming to school, to participate in the kind of the rich experiences that inspire their imagination. That's what we need in those schools. But instead, we have these we've had to date these testing regimes which have not had the effects. And we know they won't have the effects, but we can report out on the marginal differences that seem to satisfy the political object that created them in the first place.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Mary Kalantzis. She is Dean of the College of Education at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you'd like, you can also send us an email, and that is 800-222, no, that's the toll-free line. Let me try that again. 333-9455. 800-222-9455, and the email will-talk@illinois.edu. So much for multitasking. I was looking at my computer screen here. I want to talk about a little bit about No Child Left Behind. It seems sort of incredible that it's been 10 years now since that officially, almost 10 years since that went into effect. And there's been a lot of controversy about it, and that the idea was initially that by we were going to set benchmarks for student performance, and that incentives would be tied to having the kids meet those, and there would be rewards if they met them and penalties if they didn't.
Right.
And it seems that one of the problems with this has been is that rather than raising up the kids to meet the standards, we've lowered the standards, and now calling the whole thing into question. And now people are talking about, well, what are we going to do with this? Has anything positive come out of No Child Left Behind?
Actually, it was a remarkable thing for its time. First of all, it was bipartisan, right? You had Republicans and Democrats coming together to craft that policy, and education should always be bipartisan, and we need to remember that. It was really important, and that is the first point I want to make. The second point was it was revolutionary in another way. It sort of did away with the idea of intelligence testing and ability, because it said everybody can perform. Mm-hmm. And that was a radical thing to do. Everybody can perform, and we need to expect that, right? So those two things, the bipartisan nature and that expectation, are really important, and they remain important today. What occurred afterwards were the tools that you use to deliver on that. And unfortunately, a whole industry then developed around the testing and measurement of it. And it fetishized that whole area, right? And, you know, how was it going to be valid, and how was it scientific? And so it kept being reduced and reduced and reduced. And in fact, what it actually tests, what the testing regime that was created around No Child Behind, doesn't actually test the things that you need to be part of the modern world. I mean, for example, if you just take writing, which you'd think everybody needs to write, because you couldn't scientifically test it with a ticker box that could be machine marked, you know, you eliminate it from testing. So if you eliminate it from testing, you eliminate it from teaching, you know, in the same rigorous way. So we were driven by a very narrow set of goals. That's why the results, even when they show that they're improved, are not meaningful preparing young people for a world that needs collaboration, creativity, innovation, flexibility, multimodality. You know, you look at the world that our kids are actually living in, there's a very thin connecting thread between that and what the tests actually do cognitively and in terms of other aspects as well.
Mm. We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Somebody who is calling in on a cell phone on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Joined the conversation a little late, so I apologize if you guys covered this, but I did catch the tail end of your guest. And all I can speak of for an example is where I'm at. I have two kids in school. One's a junior in high school. The other one's in sixth grade. And I do echo what your guest was saying. The amount of homework that the kids are getting is ungodly, and it's every night. And what I'm finding out by talking to my children is A lot of times, my kids will come in with their homework completed, and the teacher will go, "Oh, who's got their homework done?" Maybe one or two kids. And she goes, "Oh, okay, well, that's all right. It doesn't matter. I'll give everyone an A." And I would like to say this is isolated. It only happened once in a while. But we brought it up to the principals, and we've actually gone to the board meetings. And what I'm finding out is this redundant occurrence where the principals are reporting to the board that everything is fine and everything is good and the scores are up and this is better than it was. And there's really kind of a disjointed sense of reality where a lot of times the teachers don't do that much actual teaching in the classroom because they have all these other, you know, disciplinary situations to contend with. And I don't know. I mean, it's a little overwhelming for me because I'm in my 50s. I grew up in a completely different environment, obviously. But it seems like we're going out of our way to save the bottom 10%, and those who can do better are being basically held at bay. And I'll ring off, and maybe you guys can comment on that. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well,
there was a lot in that, including that very last comment. You know, we should be ensuring that all children can reach their potential, first thing. It's not about the bottom percent or the middle percent or the top percent. And all kids should be engaged with innovation and creativity. So we need to be putting that up right out there first. Secondly, the issue of homework, you know, specifically. It's kind of what I call one of those heritage practices, right? That's what we did. We kind of went to school and we did content. And then we went home and either memorized or prepared for that content. Maybe it was math, learning our tables or whatever. But increasingly, that's an anachronism. And there should be a more fluid relationship to learning between what happens at home and what happens at school and who participates, the community that comes together around learning. And when homework is repetition, when homework is basic stuff that doesn't take kids to another level, it is a waste of time. And as we're moving forward now with new technology, the possibility And all kids now are moving into this space where they're making relationships, making meaning, using all sorts of devices and all sorts of technologies. You know, there are some schools now where the kids learn the content at home, right, because the teachers have prepared lessons online, which the kids access, and they use their parents for really meaningful knowledge, and they come to school and do what you did for homework at school, which is to go over the material, engage with others. And so you learn, it's genuinely a learning community, not remember this, repeat this, come in and do a test. So we really do have to move to a different kind of education that's good for high-performing kids and low-performing kids, or the so-called high-performing and low-performing, because the same things motivate children. You know, inquiry, investigation, pushing them beyond their capacity. All kids are excited by those kinds of things. So we would get to a better place if we're able to think that those heritage practices which control our classrooms and what happens in and out of those classrooms, we need to rethink them for a future that goes back, I say this, to thinking of the child as a whole human being and not just compartmentalize as a learner in school and as a home worker at home.
Yeah. I want to come back to the assessment problem, because that does seem to be a problem, and that is that we feel that we have this need to demonstrate student performance. And we need some way to make sure that we can compare students in one district and another, or students in one state and another. So that's where we get into these standard machine-scored tests.
Right.
And then the concern and the complaint is, well, then we become obsessed with preparing the students for the test because they have to do well, because the government says they have to do well and the taxpayers expect that they have to do well. Can we actually move toward some different way of trying to assess student performance?
Right. Not only can we must. And already the Obama government has put together two consortiums to address this very question. I mean, we're not going to see their results till about 2014 or 2015, but these two consortiums have been asked to reconsider evaluation so that it's what we call assess as you go. It's not just something at the end of a process of learning, but you evaluate a learner as they're moving along, so you can see if they are collaborating, are they working well in teams, did they get the logic of something. Not at the very end where you're testing something different from the learning. You're testing their capacity to regurgitate, you know, the kinds of tests that we have. And you really need to have, even at the end, a test that uses all their intellectual capacities, not only one set of capacities for regurgitating. So the biggest thing that we have to do in this country is address assessment at the local level and at the national level. We are moving in that direction. And again, I don't want to put all my faith in the capacity of new technology, but that too is a resource for us. We're able to capture everything a child does now in very complex ways, with video, with audio, with, you know, cloud computing. You know, we'll be able to track, we can track how children are performing when they work in these spaces, and be able to, they can get peer-to-peer feedback, you know, student-to-student. They can get parents participating. They can get the superintendent of the local school observing what they're doing. So it is time to rethink assessment as evaluation of learning, not a memory test or regurgitation of some narrow aspects of learning at the end. We need to be doing both summative and formative evaluation. And I think we're right at the moment when this is possible, with these two consortiums going in this direction and freeing us up to think that we also have to be part of this process of inventing different ways of evaluating that capture real complex performance as it's happening, and not just something at the end of a cycle of instruction.
Yeah. I have a couple of callers here I want to get right to. I'm still holding on to the old thing, or people will say we're holding on to the old thing, but can this new way of gauging performance, will that still yield you something like a report card, something that you can put on a piece of paper so that you can give that to a parent, or you can give that to somebody in the community, or again, you can do this thing of trying at least to say, how does my child, how do the students in our district compare with other students?
Right. You need to do both, not just one. Right. It's just relying on that comparison of that one score at the end that is the problem, because it doesn't really, you know, capture the whole child and how they're learning. And quite often, sometimes kids that are really good at doing those kinds of tests end up in universities where you're freer and you have to be more inventive and don't necessarily always achieve as well as they might. So you can do formative and summative and report on both of those. It is possible. It means a different kind of teaching. It means team teaching. It means communities of learners. It means using new technology to document as you go and then aggregating that. It's just that at the moment we have this one method with the scientific scoring on a narrow basis that is the problem for us. It's going to be hard for us to give that up, because you keep asking the question, you keep wanting that comparison, and you want it simple and you want it cheap, right? Mm-hmm. So whilst you ever you want that, you will get it, but it won't make a difference to your child or to the to America's children. So we've got to bite the bullet and say, how do we deliver that? We certainly need to report back for public funding. You know, most of our schools are public schools. You know, over 90% of them, it's taxpayers' money of some sort. We do need to be accountable. But we also know that the real difference is not the test score, but it's the process that goes to producing it, the quality of our teachers, and the quality of the learning experience. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk with some more folks here. Effingham is next on line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Hello. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'd like to make reference to the fact that in today's New York Times, there is a very potent op-ed about the effects of poverty in our schools, which we don't wish to discuss the success differential there, what the Finns do to ensure this great success they have, and the fact that charter schools too often are not delivering what they promise. I have a couple of questions and then a final statement. I would like to know if the countries which score so highly track students, as Germany I know used to do in the late 60s and 70s, and have a cutoff at grade 5, if they have these obscenely oversized schools, high schools, junior highs, and obscenely oversized class sizes, So those are my questions. My final statement is, well, there's two pieces, two parts to it. One, these reformers, almost en masse, did not attend public schools. And secondly, today's teachers are facing problems that I'm old, and I'm a product of a very rigid Springfield system, Springfield, Illinois system, and we learned. And yes, we had homework, and there was beautiful, there was discipline, which we may not have enjoyed, but which turned out in fairly productive people. My daughter is teaching in a junior high school in the suburb of Belleville. They have kept their pre-K classes, but they have basically eliminated EMH. And one of her seventh grade history classes of mixed abilities has a very sweet young man who has an IQ of 50 and cannot read nor really participate. And she is tormenting herself as to how she could possibly evaluate this child, for whom she has great respect and sympathy. And with that, I will be quiet. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Again, there's a lot there.
Right, there sure is. I mean, people are very passionate about education, and they're very concerned about the kinds of reforms that come every 10 years, which don't necessarily deliver on their promise. But I think we all know that socioeconomic background, poverty, right, has the most effect. Like, the effect can be up to 60%. It is the biggest effect. So in that situation, it's not just what happens at schools. It's the degree to which we're able also to help the families of the children who come from very poor backgrounds. I mean, if their health is no good, if they haven't eaten, if their family situation is traumatic, I mean, how do we reach out and create a sense of community or a sense of safety for them within the school context and where they go? Unless we can do that, which is what's called a stakeholder kind of approach to our children, we're not going to be able to change them all that much within an alienating sometimes experience of the school. So I think she's quite right there. I want to say also that tracking and streaming in the international context, you know, America has refined tracking and streaming, even though it has people within the country that says this isn't the best way to get to your results, but these are political results. I just want to say what I understand about the international scene. Decentralization matters. Hand responsibility back to schools. Empower principals, empower teachers to be able to make decisions around how they use the timetable, how they connect with the community, how they use resources. You know, whether it's Finland or Australia, that really matters. You do have to focus on underachieving pupils. You have to make special arrangements, but not to the degree that you separate them from other children. You do need to have a variety of schools that demonstrate different ways of doing things. Innovation is energizes. You know, we don't need to fear innovation. And we carry on about charter schools, but they're 5%. They're 5% of the school system. Let that experimentation happen. What we know, and researchers from our own college tell us, that charter schools perform as well and as badly as a public school system, depending on the context. Let's not focus on that. But innovation really matters, and it makes a difference. But the one thing that we can influence and control is the quality of teachers. We know that. We've known it forever. There's hard evidence to show if you've got a penny, invest it in the teacher. Ensure that the teacher is a capable profession, not a public servant that's just repeating, you know, kind of routines. They need to be assisted to be creative, to be collaborative, to bring in resources, to stay connected with higher education, you know, to bring in the community. When we turn the teacher into a routine instructor, then we limit their capacity to make a real difference.
We're at a point here we need to take a brief break, and then we have some other callers this morning here on Focus. In this first hour, our guest is Mary Calanzas. She's a dean of the College of Education at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, Dr. Jeff Swearingen will be here. He's a family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana, and we are open to any sort of health care questions you have. He sees people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, kids. So if you have a question for yourself, someone in your family, you can call. Tomorrow morning, Sandy Mason will be here for a monthly show on lawn and garden care. So that's things that grow in the home landscape. Also tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk about how some schools are dealing with the issue of obesity and trying to do what they can for kids to be healthy. We'll have three guests, Cheryl McIntyre, who's the principal of Northeast Elementary School in Danville, Wendy Starwalt, coordinator for elementary PE for Unit 4, and also Craig Gunderson. He's a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the U of I, who's done a lot of work on the issue of childhood obesity. And they'll be joining us here in studio. We'll be webcasting. You can watch. You can listen. That's tomorrow. You can take a look at the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. This morning, we're talking in this hour with Mary Calances. She is Dean of the College of Education at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also email will-talk at illinois.edu. And we'll go back to the phones here for another Effingham person. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Education being what it is and how it is socially organized and the future. And my question to your guest would be, what will education be in the near future and perhaps an elongated future, and cyberism and the computer age that, I mean, we have only begun that, I think. And then when it becomes sort of universalized, and if education will be provided through that medium, and perhaps with visiting inspectors to see how the child is doing in the home. I mean, it is rampant now, but it's mostly gossip and nonsense. But I could see the day, or I think I can envision that, when that is going to become the medium of the educative process. I'll ring off and listen for an answer. Thank you.
Well, an interesting question. What do you think?
Right, yes. It's a very interesting question. It's very hard to predict the future, right? Anyone who tries to do that gets into trouble, of course. But we can say that education, like you go in, many people have said this, you go into a school 100 years ago and a school today, you won't notice much difference. You know, it's been really hard to shift schools. One of the reasons is something that we call the duty of care, right? In a society where people work and the children are placed in these institutions called schools, we have to kind of look after them. So we put a fence, we put them in classrooms, and then we put an architecture in place and a technology that mirrored where we thought they were going to go, right? And that, you know the story. It used to be factories, work, you know, 9 to 5. However, the workplace itself has changed, the way people work. I mean, if each one of us adults out there look at the way that we work and the degree to which we use new technology for friendships, whether we're grandparents connecting with our grandkids, you know, whether we're workers, whether we're, you know, sports fans, it doesn't matter. You look from everyday life to work to interpersonal connections, we're using the new technology to make meaning in very powerful ways. You walk into a classroom, how's that happening? There's a huge gap there today. It's not a sustainable gap, because the reason we're getting this kind of terrible issue of behavior all the time in the classroom, and you know, we're trying to create maintain these heritage practices at a time when the home itself and the way kids live their everyday life is marked more and more by technology. So we have to get serious, and we educators have to not just copy and use the tools that have been created for entertainment and business, because at the moment they're the kinds of tools that are out there for gaming, for, you know, spreadsheets, for, you know, we haven't invented the tools for education. We've shunned the technology world. We've said it's somewhere else. We're in the people game. We're into relationships. We're into face-to-face. But our kids are out there doing that stuff on Facebook, on, you know, on the internet, you know, in cyberspace, you name it. So we have to invent tools for us that allow us the duty of care. How do we know where our kids are and what they're doing, right? So it's possible without being in a new world of surveillance. It is possible to be able to track what kids are doing and where they are, to allow them to collaborate with others outside of their classroom, whether it's their parents or somebody in another country, to get knowledge from anywhere, to be discerning learners of what's out there. That the old classroom that used the technology of the book. You know, originally the technology was, you know, Socrates sitting on a step and people underneath him are asking questions, right? Mm-hmm. And then we invented the book, and so everything was organized around the authority of the book and its distribution. Now knowledge is all over the place, you know, and it's being created easily. You know, you click on a screen or you know, any kind of device, and you can get a sound, you can get a letter, you can get an image, you know, like it's just phenomenal. And schools haven't yet engaged properly with it. The future will be like that. And we have to decide where learning will happen. And it won't just happen within the classroom with the rows of seats and the kids just having one audience, the teacher. One audience for their writing, one audience for the test, you know, the teacher. The audiences will be each other. The audiences might be their parents. The audiences might be the world. Like, that is where we're going. So I do believe that the change will be phenomenal, and we have to be prepared. We've been slow. That is why Obama put up that digital promise. That's why this government is going not to colleges of education for change. It's going to Time Warner. It's going to, you know, the Gates Foundation. It's going to those people who control this new media and asking them to invent the means and the tools for our children, bypassing colleges of education, because they don't believe, they think we're stuck with the book, mm-hmm. you know, with the technology and the era of the book, rather than this new moment. But we are heading there. The challenge is ours, and we're taking baby steps towards it, and we need to take a big leap and work with engineers and computer scientists and in a multidisciplinary way to understand what's happening cognitively and emotionally in this space and how we can harness the new technology, not just radio and television, but, you know, the cloud and cyberspace for knowledge and relationships and the duty of care that we have to our children.
Well, just again, I have an email here. I have another caller. I think it's exciting. Clearly, you're excited about the possibility of how technologies we have now can be used, and there seems to be the only limits is what one can imagine doing. Right. It sounds, though, from what you're saying, is that it would still be your expectation. We might not know what form it would take, but that children would still be commuting to some place, and as in groups, they would be working together in groups. So they're probably still going to go to school, right, whatever that looks like.
Right. Because it's the duty of care, remember, who will look after them. But those schools will be different. They'll be lounges. They'll be very different kind of places. There'll be small groups, large groups. There'll be teaching. I mean, the kinds of spaces that we will be creating there will be very different. And it'll turn knowledge around. That's what I said earlier about homework. Homework will not be homework. You know, you'll be learning, you know, all the time. You can learn 24 hours a day in this space. You know, your work can be put up in a site. You can engage anytime you like with anyone in the world. There's many levels at which the teacher can track what you're doing in a much more creative way, rather than sit still, put your hand up to go to the toilet, don't talk to the person next to you. You know, that kind of culture, which is now not, you can't put children in spaces like that and want them to stay there for, you know, hours on end as we do. They will rebel. They are rebelling. But it's our task, teachers, educators, media people like yourself and others, to continually be interrogating the nature of knowledge creation, dissemination, and how we can invent the future, not just pick up things invented for other domains, right, and massage them to work. I mean, the thing that I use most, which is a lovely example, is PowerPoint. PowerPoint was invented by the military. That's why it has bullet points, right? Right, and it's about a procedure. It doesn't have a narrative, and all the templates have this procedure. So in order to make it work against its nature, right, you have to eliminate the template, use it just as a space, and try to put, you know, kind of multimodal things on it that allow for a narrative. So we have to invent those things. You know, we all use PowerPoint and then put the words up and then repeat them, which is the worst kind of way that you can produce knowledge, because speaking to what people are reading delays their comprehension of it. Well, we should be doing that kind of work, doing the research. What does the new technology mean for us? What do we need to invent? At the College of Ed, we have something called the Ubiquitous Learning Institute, and we're on our way to addressing some of these issues. I'm really delighted.
We have about 10 minutes left here with Mary Galantzis. She's Dean of the College of Education, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We have some other callers. We'll get to them next. Champaign, and that's line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You've sort of addressed one of my questions, and I guess I'd like to hear you expound a little bit on what the College of Ed sees this role as in moving this issue forward. I can remember when I was an undergraduate student, there was a computer application that was generated. We called it Plato,
right,
where the teachers, the students actually learned how to put mm-hmm. lessons on the computer that other students were going to learn. Well, specifically, I was in music. But is there anything equivalent to that in the College of Ed now? Because I see that what the relationship between, for instance, the College of ACES and its land grant mission, coming up with ideas for the local farmers, that's how we got where we are with regard to agriculture. Does the College of Education see that that's also its mission? And if so, what are some of the things that are being thought of now?
Right. Bless your heart, sir. You're music to my ears. I agree with you totally. And in fact, my knowledge of Plato and the kind of breakthroughs at this wonderful land-grant university, Research One Land-Grant, I mean, this is what's special about the University of Illinois. It aims to and has created the world and served people. And the College of Ed has historically done that in so many different ways. You know, I left my country and everything that meant so much to me there to join your country. I was invited to come here because of that very potential. The university wanted to make a difference. It wanted to understand knowledge within the higher ed sector and within the school area. And we have in our College of Education a number of initiatives to collaborate with others across the campus in order to address what learning will be like into the future. We're at the moment redesigning our teacher education program with your very question in mind. We have faculty right across the college addressing issues of the way in which technology might help people with different abilities, how it might enable testing to evaluation and assessment to change, how we might address issues of diversity, how we might connect local and globally. The level of activity across our college is phenomenal. In asking these questions about the future. It hasn't been easy to get here, I have to tell you, quite honestly. It wasn't so long ago when people wanted to resist the issue of technology, as I said earlier, as if it wasn't relevant to us, or, you know, we kept looking at those the online factories that produce learning that was inferior to the kind of learning that we produce. But I think we're coming to realise that if we're going to be leaders in the field, then picking up where Plato left off is our responsibility. And we have the talent in this university and in our college to be leaders in this area. And sometime perhaps we might actually just address that particular issue, because I think that is, for the university and for our college, the most important thing we can do at this point in time.
All right. Line two in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I wanted to say, years and years ago, my father was an administrator in the Santa Fe, New Mexico public schools, and was very involved in, I suppose, the experiment of the time, which had to do with what were called open classrooms. He worked really hard to get those into that public school system. Unfortunately, and to kind of counteract the effects of what he called cell and bell classrooms, where you're in one classroom, a bell rings and you go to the next classroom, and then the bell rings, you go to the next classroom, et cetera, where your inquiry is totally dictated to you, and you're not, really more free to explore things in your own way. But he told me that that system failed, that the teachers hated it, that parents disliked it. But it sounds like some of what you're talking about now is similar to that. And I'm wondering if you can tell me what happened to that concept, and if you are looking towards those sorts of ideas now in some way.
Right. Yes, from Summer Hill through to what your family did, there have been lots of arguments and cases put about the importance of children and learners living at school. They're actually there as real human beings living, right? They're not just there as learners of history or learners of English as set by a particular curriculum. We know that. However, there were demands, that kind of learning, right, that had a bell ringing, that had very strict ways of moving from one thing to the other, was really useful in preparing people for the kind of world and the kind of work that existed. The case that I'm making is that the world actually has changed. The way we relate, the way we work has changed, in part by new technology, in significant ways. And we have to recognize the affordances now of that new technology for doing those things that we couldn't do before, right? And it goes, as I said, back to the duty of care. We can track kids now. We can know what they're doing in any space in a building, right? They don't have to be in one classroom for us to know what they're doing. We can teach kids to be responsible and discerning. In fact, we need to teach them to be responsible and discerning in more open spaces because the world's like that. We need them to... there's so much that they have access to that just giving them what is good for them isn't enough anymore. We have to help them understand how to navigate around the ton of stuff that's coming with them in all sorts of ways, and to discern what they need, what they need for what purposes, what is healthy, what is unhealthy. I mean, we have to prepare a different kind of human being for a different kind of future. And that's, I think, what's different at the moment and might make these ideas that many have understood for decades and decades more relevant today with new technologies and new architectures. By that, I mean new kinds of classrooms, new organization of teachers' labor. Those sorts of things have to be rethought if we're really going to prepare the kind of learner that's going to be innovative, creative, collaborative, deeply knowledgeable and discerning. We need a different kind of person, and the original classroom and its learning outcomes in the way that it organized is less relevant for the future that our kids are entering.
I have a couple email questions here I want to make sure we try to get in. Here's someone who writes that that her youngest child is now in seventh grade, having been through several school districts due to various moves. She writes, "It's been my experience that middle school hasn't really been considered as important as elementary school and high school. This is showing itself in Champaign via the 10 and 20-year plans the school board has created. It doesn't even bring up the middle schools, instead focusing on elementary schools and high schools entirely." Right. And she wonders, has she just had some bad experiences, or
right,
is that a pattern
right,
do you
right.
see all over?
Well, two responses. One, she's right. Middle schools matter because that's where kids make the transition, make the cognitive leap and transition into a different way of understanding the world. But right now, we have middle schools in our state, at least, made systemically important because the state will be requiring us to prepare teachers with a separate license for the middle school. So I think finally that's been recognised that we need to put a special focus in that period to catch kids that might not have made the kinds of leaps that were required to prepare them for the kind of work in the high school. And it is an extraordinary productive and creative period in the life of learners, and we need to focus on ensuring that the environment is as creative as they are at that point in time.
I want to make sure I get this one more here because I think it says something about parental expectations and how they get into the mix. Someone here writes, our school used to have a great report card that was based on a continuum, and the teacher noted where each child was on the continuum on their report card. It was brilliant and nuanced and showed how your child was developing in a variety of skill sets over the years. However, parents demanded to know if their child was an A or a C. So now we have grade-based cards where teachers are discouraged from writing comments. I think encouraging teachers to know their students and have a dialogue with parents is so important, and the grades just don't help any more than the generic tests do.
Right. The new consortia that have been put together to design assessments for the Common Core standards will have at least 4 points along the year where results are given back to parents and to students and to teachers. So I think we're going to a more systematic way now of having the result at the end, because we can't give up on that. That's just human nature. People are competitive and they want to know where their kid competes with everybody else. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, it's just in our DNA, I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's one thing that's there. But competition is there and sharing is there equally, right? And we also, but as we've said, everybody tells you it's not good enough. Even for the kid that's getting an A, that kind of result isn't good enough. You need to know what they need along the way and how they're performing along the way on more complex indicators. We're going to get that if these two consortia come up with the rich results that we hope. At least it is a shift in thinking about assessment and evaluation. In the meantime, because parents insist on that ABC and that sort of competitive easy, it's an easy thing, right? It makes it harder. So my plea to parents is, don't just want that. Okay. It's not good for you and it's not good for your children.
We're going to have to stop. We have one caller. I can't take my apologies, but I'm sure we'll be getting back to these issues again on another day. For the moment, we have to say thanks to our guest, Mary Colanza. She is Dean of the College of Education, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David, and thank you to all your callers.